I'm Mindy Todd. Welcome to The Point Today, gardening with horticulturist and entomologist Roberta Clark. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, it's we've had a little bit of rain. It's been kind of cool. Just really like the last week or so starting to feel like the season's finally here.
We're having one of those Cape Cod summers that don't quite seem to get here. And then we go right into hot mm-hmm. summer. It's just been a very long winter. I think it didn't end until sometime in April. And then spring has been very cool. I'm hoping it's ended now, although about a week and a half ago, it was literally 46 degrees at 6:30 in the morning at my house. And I'm going, what the heck? You know, it's June.
I know.
It's been very cool. And we've had a lot of, up until 2 weeks ago, we had a lot of rain, a lot of gray days. So I'm just like saying, well, we're in England this year.
So we're about, a couple weeks behind, maybe?
In terms of growth on plants, yeah, I would say we're about 2 weeks behind in the terms of when things are blooming or how plants are doing in the garden. My cool weather crops in the vegetable garden have been going gangbusters. Mm-hmm. They're really good. My warm weather crops... they're growing, but perhaps a little slowly.
I mentioned to you, I only put in 3 tomato plants this year. Usually I do a lot more. And I'm like, oh, they're kind of small. They're still kind of, and it's just not been warm enough for them.
It has not. I've gone, because I'm now at the age where I don't like to buy green bananas. So I'm buying bigger plants, not the ginormous ones.
Right.
You know, I have to set limits on myself. But I buy plants that are further along. I don't buy six pack.
Yeah. Well, and now it's probably a little bit late.
Six pack season is over.
Yeah. Now, so what does this mean in terms of our vegetable crops? The tomatoes are going to be a little bit late, right?
I'm thinking unless we get into really hot, sultry weather, everything's going to be delayed. So if you're hoping to get fresh tomatoes by 4th of July, I doubt
that
you will.
That never happens in my yard.
Even if you plant the variety 4th of July. I'm sure there are those really serious gardeners who start things ahead of time and keep them in special conditions. And I used to have a master gardener, Harry Walker, who would walk into my office at the end of May and put a ripe tomato on my desk and just, to get my goat.
Yeah.
And he did.
Yeah.
So there are those folks who will have tomatoes, but the vast majority of us, if I get a tomato by late July, I think I'm going to be lucky.
Yeah.
And some folks, it may push into August, depending on what you planted, when you planted it.
Exactly. So don't despair if you're feeling like you're a little behind, and don't give up on something that might not have sprouted yet. Like I was looking at my crepe myrtle and I was like, I don't know. And I just see a couple of tiny little things towards the bottom, a little bit like my hydrangeas, but I'm not touching it for maybe another couple more weeks and see what happens.
I'm being very selective. I have 2 crepe myrtles. One I only put in about 5 years ago, and 2 winters ago it died to the ground, but it came back. This year I'm looking at it and going, I'm really seriously concerned about that. The other one's been in the ground for, 15, 20 years. And again, 2 years ago it died back, but it resprouted quite nicely.
Too, yeah.
I'm looking at and I cut all the dead wood out of it. I'm looking at that now, and frankly, I see no signs of life.
Yeah.
But I'm waiting. The other plant that I have some serious concerns about, and maybe there are listeners out there who also have this plant and theirs is showing signs of life, is Vitex, which is one of my absolute favorite plants for color in August. Just fabulous blue flowers on it. I see nothing.
Nothing. Well, and we're really kind of pushing the envelope with the crepe myrtle. I mean, it's really, it's a little bit more of a southern plant, but
there's been a lot of plant development, plant breeding, particularly at the National Arboretum, where one of the research scientists, a plant breeder there, did develop a line of crepe myrtles that were more hardy, but still.
Yeah. We get a bad winter.
Sometimes it's just, we're not going to have them
Yeah. 866-999-4626 is our number for your garden questions, stories, comments. 866-999-4626. Advice. We'd always love advice. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. Despite what some people, we do not know everything.
No, absolutely not.
We actually had Nan, or Nance from Brewster, had sent in a photo of a bug when Mark Faraday was here, and he couldn't really identify it, so we thought we would ask you about that. I'm sorry, that was Janet who sent in that. And so, you know what it was?
Well,
picture?
Off the top of my head, I'd want to Google it just to confirm it. It looks like what we call a Dobson fly, which is not a fly. Mm-hmm. It's a fairly large insect, and its larva is what is commonly called, I believe, a doodle bug. Mm-hmm. And they like sandy soil, the larvae, and they create these like funny little pits where ants fall into, and then they pop out, they hide at the bottom, and they pop out, and they have very long mandibles, and they prey on insects that fall into their little pits.
Well, certainly ants, there's plenty of those around.
Oh, yes, yeah. Yes.
All right, so this is Nan's question. Nan is in Brewster. She says, love the garden show. I have peonies in the same bed where some plants flower, but others do not. Should I dig up non-blooming plants now or in the fall and replant plants shallower? Also, what kind of fertilizer, if any, should I use for dahlias? She isn't saying what the other plants are. Certainly the peonies need a shallow...
You don't want the eye... For peonies, you don't want the eye more than, say, an inch and a half below, 2 inches max below the surface
Otherwise
of the soil.
Otherwise, it might not flower.
It won't flower. It will grow just fine, but it won't flower. This was a fabulous year for peonies.
Oh, I know. Mine were great.
I mean, so I'm, you know, moaning about, you know, oh, it's late and, you know, it's been cold. Some plants absolutely loved it. My peonies, one particular cultivar, which I've long since lost the tag, so I don't know what it is. I have never seen such magnificent bloom on this. It's got beautiful pink single petals and a big fluff of white puffy stuff in the middle. And it was just stunning. I'm going, wow. And every day a new flower would open up. It was just massively in bloom. So the peonies were great. Peonies can be moved. If you read the books, they'll say wait till fall. My philosophy on a lot of things is, yes, there may be a ideal time to do it, but in my book, if I have time to do it and it needs to be done, I do it. I mean, I wouldn't be doing it in the end of July, you know, or early August. But yes, right now or wait till fall.
Or when it stops flowering.
When it stops flowering.
Yeah, would be a good time. And Nan, if you want to give us a call and tell us what other non-blooming plants you're talking about, we'd be happy to help. Fertilizer, if any on the dahlias?
For dahlias, I just use a general-purpose plant fertilizer with a low in nitrogen. So the numbers, the first number would be lower than the second number. You could use a plant tone. You could use a 5-10-5. I generally stay away from the soluble type of fertilizers simply because they are quick feeds, and then they're gone. Mm-hmm. So you really need to be, if you're relying on them, you really need to be applying them every couple of weeks on a regular basis.
What I do with my dahlias is when I bring them up, I put them in little pots until they start to sprout, just in case they don't.
Yes.
And I put the lobster compost in there with them, which I know then they probably get in the ground and go, wait, what? Where's all that great lobster? So I try to put a little bit around before I plant them in there. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. And then we have an email here that says, I have an old-fashioned purple lilac that came with the house 7 years ago. I've pruned it to remove old stems and increase bloom without a lot of success. Treated for powdery mildew each year and have curled brown leaves on half the bush this year. I'm wondering if it isn't time to replace it with a more disease-resistant lilac hybrid. The ever-blooming lilacs don't produce the same large blooms and seem to be much smaller. Are there disease-resistant standard lilacs available?
Most of the lilacs are subject depending on their location and their treatment, to a number of disorders. I don't think that should, they're severe enough that that should discourage anyone from growing lilacs if you really love them. The old-fashioned purple lilac,
beautiful.
You
yeah.
find it growing at old abandoned farmsteads, you know, and it's been there for years and years and years and years. And yes, it gets powdery mildew, and it may get, they get a bacterial blight in wet years, so you might see that this year because April and May and the early part mm-hmm. of June were wet. So you might see that. But they, you know, prune out any diseased wood and they come back. If you'd rather go for something a little more up-to-date, the ever-blooming, I think the cultivar is named Bloomerang or mm-hmm. something
yeah.
like that. I have it. It's lovely. It is a much smaller plant.
Mm-hmm.
And it does rebloom, not prolifically,
not a lot, yeah.
but it does rebloom. For a more compact lilac that doesn't seem to get powdery mildew or the bacterial blight, there are a couple of different species. The Korean lilac, Syringa patula, and the variety you want to look for is Miss Kim. Tends to get maybe 4 feet tall and 4 feet wide over time, has prolific smaller flower heads of purple, very fragrant. Another one is Syringa Meyeri, Meyer's lilac, which frequently in the trade, it's mislabeled as Miss Kim. They look almost identical. One has larger leaves than the other, but the blooms are almost identical. And again, it doesn't get powdery mildew. I've have both of those. They've never gotten bacterial blight. So they're pretty much carefree. Mm-hmm. One of them is even pretty much in a shaded location. I think it's the Meyeri with the small leaves. And it blooms like crazy.
And the white lilacs, I feel like they're a little bit more fragrant than the purple ones.
Some of them are. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
Jack Alexander, who was the former head propagator up at the Arnold Arboretum, he was a lilac guru, and he put together a list, and you can probably find it at the Arboretum
yeah.
publications, on which Arnoldia is the magazine that the Arboretum puts out, and it's a number of years ago, but he did an article on the fragrance of different cultivars of lilacs.
A few years ago, when I was perusing Soar's Gardens, they had a yellow lilac.
Yes.
And I am kicking myself that I did not buy that. Although at the time I was like, I love this. And I said, where are you going to put that? And I really didn't have any place to put it, which is why I didn't buy it. But I still think about that.
Well, I'm not buying woody plants anymore because I literally don't have place. And I said I was not going to be buying perennials this year, but I didn't.
We just cannot, unless we completely stay away, which we can't do.
No, I work at a garden center.
I know,
so
it's really hard, but we have to be more selective on what we bring home. Christine is giving us a call from Harwich. Good morning, Christine.
Good morning.
Good morning.
We have a problem with ivy, very aggressive ivy, crawling all over the lawn. What is the best way to pull it out, to deal with it? Can something be applied to stunt its growth?
That's English ivy, heterohelix. Many of us grew up, it was one of our very first house plants. It was frequently used as a ground cover in landscapes, and it grows up and encompasses trees, or it was growing up chimneys and escapes. It is very vigorous. It seems to love the Cape Cod, and it will take over.
Yeah, pulling it out.
There are herbicides. Certainly, if you don't mind using an herbicide, there are herbicides that will take care of it. I would recommend you go to your local garden center and read some labels and talk with the employees who work in that particular section of the garden center, and they should be able to advise you on the proper material. But it's mostly a matter of just being rigorous at pulling it out. I removed it from, I had a fairly large patch going up my chimney and spreading out into an adjacent garden. And it took me a couple of years to get rid of all of it.
Yeah.
But eventually you can do it. But it's a lot of work.
Yeah, Christine, I had the same problem. But you know what? Ask around, because you might have some friends who actually want some of that ivy. I had a friend who had, you know, a yard that she, same thing, she was trying to do a little ground cover and, you know, sort of a hilly thing. And she came and helped me dig some of it out. So you might have some folks. That's the thing, too, when you have, when somebody's, hey, would you like to come and have some of this? There's a reason.
Right, exactly. When your friends have too much of something and they want to give it away, you might want to think about that. Yes.
Yeah. Christine, thanks for the call. Good luck with that. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking with horticulturist and entomologist Roberta Clark. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. So we've been talking about how we had, you know, pretty good amount of rain up, you know, for April and a bit of May. And that means mosquitoes.
I don't recall having this many mosquitoes in my neighborhood in quite some time. I mean, you run the gauntlet just going out to pick up the paper in the morning. I normally do not particularly like using DEET, particularly on my skin, just my own feelings about it. But if I'm going to be working in the yard, I spray my clothing, I spray my shoes, I spray my hat. And now that the weather has warmed up, I have bare arms and bare legs, so I have to spray my arms and my legs. And I need to reapply it after I've been outside for a couple of hours. It's just miserable. So my advice to folks is, and I have to remind myself to take my own advice, I go around my yard and I'm astounded at how many empty pots or trays or pot saucers or just little nooks and crannies that I've been careless about have been collecting moisture. And those are the perfect breeding place for mosquitoes. So while it's not going to change the overall picture in your entire neighborhood, it's certainly going to help a little bit in your own environment.
Yeah. We have an email from Wayne in West Tisbury. He says, I love to grow peonies. I have a garden of single white and pink peonies and another far away of double red peonies. This year in my red garden, an incredibly beautiful, huge double white peony appeared. I did not plant it there. Also, a red has come up with my white / pink peonies. What is going on here? I would also like to remind everyone that the official start to summer is in late June, and on the Cape and Islands, we have had what I would call a spring. Winter is not supposed to turn into summer. It's supposed to be cool, cold, and wet. My plants, grass, and I have loved it.
He has a point.
Yeah, and I mean, say I'm loving this weather right now.
I don't mind the cool temperatures. I've actually enjoyed the temperatures working outside in the upper 60s.
Yes.
I think, to me, that is the perfect gardening weather, maybe even as high as 72. What I've had a problem with is all the moisture. Well, it's been great for the plants, but, you know, I work 3 days a week at a local garden center, and it seemed like every day off,
I know it.
It rained, and I couldn't go out in the yard, so it was frustrating
for me.
Well,
for a while there, we were in that weather cycle where it was like, rain on the weekend and then beautiful on Monday.
Yeah. But in regards to the peonies, there's a possibility, I can't attest to it as actually happening, that some natural hybridization has been going on there. If this bed has been established for a long time, it might be you're getting some crosses and they've established enough so they're now blooming, which is kind of a cool thing.
Yeah, you know, for sure.
I mentioned the peonies. It was a great year. There are so many wonderful peonies, and they're such a statement plant in the perennial border that I just think everyone should have several.
Okay. At least one, yeah. Well, you know, it's funny because, you know, over my garden has gotten quite crowded, and I've been over the last few years trying to thin things out, and I've forgotten some of the things.
Yeah.
And so this year, because all of my peonies have bloomed this year, that isn't always the case, they were all white, you know, with a little kind of red pinkish.
Yes, that's Maxima Festiva.
Which is beautiful, but I don't have any pink, or so I have to go get some more peonies so I can have some more colors.
Yeah.
But yeah, so.
Yeah, I have probably one of the best that I have outside of the one that blooms so fantastically, the pink with the fluffy white center, was one given to me by Master Gardener Dave Babbitt years and years and years ago. He was digging them. He had just bought a house on Route 6A in Barnstable, and he was thinning them out. They were in front of the front porch, and he said, "Do you want a clump?" I said, "Oh, sure." Didn't know what it was, you know, a variety or anything. And I just heeled it in. I didn't know where I wanted to put it, so I heeled it in between two of my raised vegetable beds on the side yard where it gets full sun. I've never moved it. You know, it heeled in was another way of saying this is now your home. And it's magnificent. It's a fully doubled, deep raspberry pink.
Oh, how pretty.
And I like in spring, before the buds actually open, to just literally cut an armful and bring it in and put it in a large vase. And it's just the most magnificent. Or you don't have to do anything. Just plop them in a vase and they're beautiful.
That's so funny. My sister-in-law is visiting and I put a vase with a couple of peonies and a oriental poppy.
Nice.
And I said, "Oh, did you see the flowers I put in your room?" She's like, "I thought they were fake. They were so perfect."
Wonderful.
So one of the challenges is getting your perennial flower bed to a place where you have color throughout the season. And so when you're beginning, you know, like spring, you got all this great stuff, and then you might have a lull, and then, you know, later. So give us some tips on how you plan that, how you can think about, so if something in color. I mean, when you're first starting, you can always throw some annuals in there to sort of spruce it up. But that's always a challenge, to always have something.
Well, it is a challenge, particularly if you're gardening in shade, which a lot of folks on the Cape are. I have both shade and sun gardens, and then I have dappled sun, and just you name the exposure, I think I have it in my yard. So I always suggest to folks that they not concentrate on flowers, but look to foliage, because that's, frankly, what you're going to be looking at the most, because a perennial will be in bloom. The average perennial will be in bloom for about 2 weeks. You have those perennials, like the peonies, mine have been in bloom, it's still in bloom, for about 3 weeks now. You have others that bloom for an even longer period of time, but the average perennial is about 2 weeks. And then what do you have? You have foliage.
Hosta.
Green is a color, and with hosta, you have green, you have gold, you have white, you have variegated, you have some with red stems, some that bloom early with beautiful purple flowers. Some people don't like the flowers, so they cut them off immediately.
Oh, you're kidding.
Yeah. But there's an old publication from UMass. I think it was written in the 1980s, but it's still quite relevant in terms of trying to plan out a perennial border that has a sequence of bloom throughout the season. And I believe that's what it's even called, a sequence of bloom in the perennial garden, or some combination of those words. And it's based on the research perennial beds that no longer exist, unfortunately, but they existed at the old Waltham Field Station. Mm. Boy, I'm dating myself here. The old Waltham Field Station on Beaver Street, where so much wonderful research was done by scientists from UMass. And the perennial border there, they had separate beds with all sorts of different perennials in them. And a wonderful publication was written that started in April and went through October, listing those plants that bloomed in that sequence, and it gave their heights, their colors, you know, all sorts of good information. So I think if people can go to the UMass Landscape website and look in their fact sheets, they will come upon that publication.
Yeah, I have a shaded area where I have a lot of hosta, and I had put in a couple of columns with planters on top. Don't have them this year. I've moved them. But for the last couple of years in there, what I've put in there was the sweet potato vine with the yellow begonias on each side.
Oh, how lovely.
And in that shade, it just kind of, you know, perks
pop
it up, that
color.
Little that pop of color and that lime green. It
One of my favorite hostas this year that's looking particularly wonderful is a variety I picked up a number of years called Goodness Grows. And it's a medium to large hosta with bright golden, lime green golden foliage with a dark streak of green down the middle of it.
Oh, I have some of that. I didn't know that was
just,
what it's called. Yeah.
Just lovely. And mm-hmm. it's in a very shaded location, and that gold lime green color just brightens it up.
Yeah, in the shade. When mine has a little bit more sun in it, and some of the plants will have the stripe and some will not. I think the sun maybe changes the color a little bit. Larry is calling us from East Ham. Hi, Larry.
Hi. I need to rejuvenate an asparagus bed, which got neglected and had some weeds in the bottom. And I was thinking this would be the time to pull the weeds out and fertilize it while it's growing. And I wondered if that was the right strategy and if there are any recommendations about what fertilizer to use.
Yeah, I mean, if you have an asparagus bed, and I had an incredible crop this year. It was a good year for asparagus. Right now is a great time. I've stopped picking my asparagus, and I'm letting it go to fern. So, yes, get out there and beg your pardon?
Yeah, we stopped harvesting about a week ago.
Yeah. So get out there, give it a really good weeding. If you have access to aged cow manure. I know it's something that's worth its weight in gold here on the Cape, but the real stuff, not the bagged stuff, or any type of manure, aged sheep manure, aged goat manure.
Horse?
Not so much horse, because when you get horse manure, mostly what you're getting is a lot of bedding in it, and I'm looking for the real deal.
Would you say not to use the bagged?
I don't like the bagged. I think if you can get, I mean, it's fine to work into the soil, but you can't really work anything into the soil because you're going to be damaging the crowns. So if you can find a source of manure, people in your neighborhood or your town have animals, even rabbit manure, give the bed a really good top dressing.
And the chicken.
A chicken manure. Chicken. It can be a little hot. So if it's composted, yes. But I've used cow, I use horse in other areas, but sheep, goat, and rabbit manure are the four that I go to in terms of, sound crazy. My kids used to call me queen of manure. I top dress it with real manure. And then next spring, use a fertilizer that's high in nitrogen. And you should see a nice renovation regrowth.
All right. Larry, good luck with that.
Thank you.
Thanks for calling. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. My friend's daughter used to garden with me a lot. And when she was about, she was about eight or so. And she was helping me with the top dressing and with the wheelbarrow. And she sticks her hands in there and she goes, "Let's use this really good durian." I'm like, "That is actually manure." Her face was just priceless. But, you know, I was telling you before we went on the air, I had a little walkway that I put through. The garden, sometimes it gets a little overwhelming. It's a little large. So I was like, you know, I'm going to just put an arbor here and put a little, path through the garden.
Yep. Give it some structure.
Yeah. And so I've had bluestone there for quite a while. And now that we have the grandson, I said, I think I'm going to move that bluestone because I can see a cracked head coming here in the future.
Yes.
And I put pine. I really debated what would be the best thing. I put pine needles down there. And what a great little path that
nice
makes.
Nice and soft.
Yeah. I had thought about using seaweed, but it sticks to your feet and you kind of take it with you. And so, and then I was like, but the pine needles.
Yeah.
And they're not as easy to come by always as you think they would be unless you have them.
Unless
in your
you
yard.
Have some pine trees in your yard. Yeah.
Yeah. So, but it works great. We have here. We love the pretty annual agatash. Can these be put indoors to survive the winter?
They do not survive the winter that well. Some of the agastaches are perennial. Blue Fortune is one. I'm growing one this year that has, what is the name of it? I can't remember. It's got golden leaves with the blue flowers, so it's particularly lovely. But they, most of them, the ones with the apricot colored flowers, they are more tropical. They're sort of like the beautiful salvias, that black and blue. I'm growing one now called Rio, Argentine Sunset. They're beautiful, and I'd love to keep them every year because the hummingbirds love them, but they don't overwinter. They're truly annuals. And I believe the Agastache, most of them, other than the ones, the Blue Fortune and other varieties of truly perennial, will not overwinter indoors.
I don't have those. So are they a seed or are they a bulb? I mean, the flower, could you like harvest some seeds from them to save? Or?
You can buy seed. It won't be a named cultivar. It'll just be the straight species. And the perennials actually seed themselves in the garden. They're really lovely. Birds love them to pick seeds out later in the season. Butterflies love them. They have some fragrance to the foliage. They're really lovely, but other than the perennial ones that you grow in the garden year-round, the other ones are pretty much,
put them back every year. All right, Linda's calling from Orleans. Hi, Linda.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was wondering if you had any advice about soil-borne insects, probably nymphs or larvae, that every single year eat my zinnia seedlings. I put them in the ground. Put perfectly healthy zinnia
and then something eats
seedlings
them
into the ground, and within 2 days the leaves have all turned brown and been eaten. I've tried diatomaceous soil, I've tried all the nice things you can do.
Right.
And I don't
My best guess is it's probably earwigs. A lot of people don't realize that they can really be quite a pest, and they absolutely love zinnia seedlings. I've had multiple zinnias eaten by earwigs, and they feed at night, so you never see them. And I have tried diatomaceous earth with mixed success. This year when I put mine in, I decided I wanted to be a little more aggressive in protecting my zinnias, and I used the product on the garden shelf called 8, which is a replacement for the old-fashioned 7. It's an actual insecticide. It is not organic. It contains permethrin, which is a synthetic form of pyrethrin, but it works pretty good. And I only buy a small, you know, handheld with a trigger, because I don't need tons of it. And I spritz them a couple of times for the first week or so until I see some nice growth and they've got some strength to them, and then I don't do it again. And that's the only way I've really protected them from earwigs.
And Jenny's saying, look for empty stem tubes that the earwigs are hiding in there.
Yes. Another master gardener, Al Saperstein from Harwich, and this was a kind of a great idea he had. He would take pieces of bamboo about 12 inches long, hollow bamboo, and he would lay them out in his garden. And first thing in the morning, very early, he'd go out with a bucket of water and he'd pick up these pieces of bamboo and basically tap them into this bucket of water, and literally hundreds of earwigs would come falling out into the water and drown. So if you don't mind doing that.
Yeah,
I would bludgeon them to death if I could.
You could. Yeah, exactly.
Thanks for the call, Linda. Good luck with your zinnias. Let us know how it works out this time for you. All right, Barbara's calling from North Chatham. Good morning, Barbara.
Hi, Roberta. This is your office mate of many years ago at Extension again with a couple scientific-type questions about plants.
Good to hear from you, Barbara. How are you?
I'm still thinking, but anyway, I've discovered all the gardeners and people around here don't understand the importance of length of day. I gardened in Maine, and you could grow things there that you can't grow here just because the daylight is never long enough.
Yeah.
And I just wondered how many people really understand that we have certain things that's what's required.
Well,
and the other thing, yes, go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
The other question is, because I'm really not that great at this, but I discovered my holly, which is a volunteer, and my new schemia, they are very thick evergreen leaves, and then they would start to turn sort of yellow, like, and I thought the plant was dying, but then sure enough, you wait a few months and they all goes away. And is this their way of shedding?
Yes.
By turning yellow and dropping off?
Yep. All right. The first question is all about what we call photoperiod, which refers to the length of day. And some plants are what we call day neutral. They don't care whether it's a long day or a short day. But many plants are sensitive to photoperiod or the length of the day. The types of onions that they grow in the South, the Vidalias and some of the other southern onions, really don't grow well up here, not because we don't have the soils to sustain them, but because we have a different photoperiod up here. Spinach is one that's very tied into photoperiod. Its reproductive cycle is triggered but not only by warm temperatures, but by day length. And as soon as the days start getting longer, it bolts and goes to seed. We have other plants that actually don't begin to do their reproductive process until the days begin to shorten in the fall. So photoperiod is very important. And if people are really interested in learning more about that, you know, Google is everyone's friend. Mm-hmm. So you can Google photoperiod in plants and find out a lot about what plants prefer certain day lengths. And then you have areas like in northern Scotland and in Alaska where they get, and other parts of the world, where they get into the almost 24-hour day length in the summer. And that's really, they grow incredible. There's a famous garden in Scotland whose name I will never remember that would grow incredible, ginormous cabbages because they had such long day.
Yeah.
And the other one about the hollies, and you hit that one on the head, Barbara, that is most plants drop their older leaves in the fall, but hollies in particular, also rhodes to a certain extent and skimmia, their oldest leaves start in sometime in May. They become spotted, they turn yellow, they look horrible, and you look at your holly and say, oh my God, it's got some horrible disease. Actually, no, it's just getting rid of its older foliage, and this sort of corresponds with bud break, and you'll see new growth coming out, and if you wait a couple of weeks, the plant looks fabulous.
Yeah. All right, Barbara, thanks for the phone call.
Okay, thank you.
Sure. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking with horticulturist and entomologist Roberta Clark. 866-999-4626 for your comments, questions, advice. 866-999-4626. Our email, thepoint@capeandislands.org. All right, so we always have some, you know, the pests vary from year to year. And this actually has been a really good year. Good year for us, not good year for the winter moths and the gypsy moths, but there are some hot spots, and poor Amy has one of those hot spots in her yard with the gypsy moths. I was like, oh no, because there's not a lot of them around. They're all at Amy's house.
They're all at Amy's house. Yeah, it's like I've seen one gypsy moth in a caterpillar in my yard. That's it. Last year, I seemed to be crawling with them. I saw maybe half a dozen little green inchwormy winter moth caterpillars early this year. I'm getting blueberries for the first year in I can't tell you how long, because the winter moths simply weren't there to feed on the reproductive parts.
Yeah, this is the second year my apple tree is going to have apples.
I'm having pears. When I planted it, it was a 3-in-1 Asian pear. Somehow I've lost those Asian pear branches. And they all look like regular old pears now, but there are a lot of them.
Yeah.
So for much of the Cape, the caterpillar pressure has been really low this year, but there are always hot spots. And the gypsy moth in areas where the population did not collapse last year, then there are gypsy moths.
So what can Amy do?
This late in the season, nothing.
Yeah.
They will be pupating soon. And then you'll see the moths, the male moths flying around. The female moths don't fly. They're egg-laying machines. So next year, if the population does not collapse, if you don't see the caterpillars suddenly wilting, if they all successfully can pupate and emerge as adult moths and lay eggs, then you might want to be proactive next year.
With some spinosad?
Some spinosad. Probably gypsy moths usually hatch in early May, depending on the season. They were a little late this year, but they did hatch nonetheless. Mm. And treat the foliage of your trees with spinosad in mid to late May.
Mm. The other thing that's happening, and I've mentioned this before, every year it gets better and better with the red lily leaf beetle. My lilies look fantastic. Yeah, the leaves are actually, there's no holes in them.
I can't even remember when it was. I participated in a research project with URI, Dr. Richard Casagrande, where we selected a couple of different sites, one of which was the fairgrounds in Falmouth. One was happened to be, my yard.
Your yard, yeah.
Where we released a parasitoid, little fly, wasp, I can't remember which it was these days, and then every summer I would collect larvae and send them down to the research lab at URI, and then we started recovering the parasite in the larvae. So it became established, and now, of course, it's fairly widespread. Mm-hmm. And so while the thing with biological control is it never totally wipes out.
Right, so they still have some.
They have to have the pest in order to keep the parasitoid going. But it's really manageable.
Yes.
So manageable. I've seen just an incredible reduction in the amount of lily leaf beetle in my yard, and I'm thrilled with that. We do have currently a rose slug sawfly is out on roses. I'm expecting hibiscus sawfly to be on perennial hibiscus any week now. In the vegetable garden, cucumber beetle. Ooh, I hate them. Colorado potato beetles. Squash vine borer will be coming out within the next, probably early July. It's when the adult emerges. So we always have our complement of pests. Mm-hmm. Earwigs on zinnias.
Yeah. Those earwigs. They're on my dahlias.
Yeah, they get on dahlias too. So, it's
it's always a challenge, always something.
It's a dog-eat-dog world there. Yeah.
Right. Marilyn has sent us a note. She says, I've had good luck overwintering black and blue salvia. I just put them in a big pot in the cold basement. I try to remember to water about once a month, and I bring them up in April. I had one plant that I overwintered twice.
Oh, how fabulous. Congratulations. Yeah. I think that is wonderful. My problem with overwintering things in the basement, I have a very cold basement, and it's wonderful for my dahlias. I mean, they go through the winter fine, but anything that requires, I go down there and water them, if it's only once a
month. Forgot about you. Yeah.
And they turn crispy.
Yeah.
So congratulations. I think that's wonderful.
You know, my rosemary never makes it through, maybe until about February, right? So I had one that was, it got so big, but they don't really like to be moved.
No.
So here was my trick. I dig a hole around the rosemary. And I just leave it for a day or two. And then I lift it up out of the spot and I just put it next to it. I'm watering while I'm doing this. Let's sit it there for a couple of days. Then I put it in a pot right there and I let it sit for a couple of days. Then I move it to the porch and then I move it in the house. And I was able to do that with this rosemary for several years until it got too big
to
that
move.
I couldn't do that anymore.
Yeah.
So there's a will, there's a way.
There is. And perhaps the gentleman who wanted to overwinter his agastaches could try this technique. Put it in a very large pot so it has ample root space. Put it in a cold basement and make sure you remember to water it once a month.
Yeah. I want to talk about weeds for a minute because
I've got them.
I know. And some weeds, but a lot of times beauty is in the eye of the beholder, as they say. I think Queen Anne's lace is very pretty. But
I love Queen Anne's lace.
A lot of people think of it as a weed. And I pull some of it, but I leave some. And I'm just kind of thinking, they have a purpose, right? I mean, there are pollinators.
They are pollinators.
These weeds, right?
Yep.
So it's not a bad thing to leave.
No,
some
they're
weeds
pollinator
in there.
Plants, and I leave a lot of them because they also make excellent cut flowers.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a coworker who one year collected. If you notice, when the flowers go by, the seed heads have these long sort of outer, they're not petals, I believe they're sepals, that sort of curve in around the seed head. And she collected those and hung them upside down till they were dry. And she spray painted them white.
Oh.
And she used them in Christmas arrangements.
What a great idea.
And it was just the most beautiful use of a natural material. So, yes, beauty's in the eye of the beholder. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of weeds out there that I enjoy. I actually like dandelions, and I don't remove them because they're one of the earliest blooming weeds that honeybees can utilize. So I enjoy them.
Yeah. So you mentioned the dandelions. Now, my grandson, I've been trying to teach him, you can pick anything that's growing in the grass,
yes,
but not in the garden beds. And I had a butterfly bush that died a few years ago, but at the bottom of that butterfly bush is this beautiful pink tulip. I don't know where it came, but it comes up every year and it's a nice big tulip, but it is in the grass. So when he came walking up with that tulip in his hand, I couldn't say, because it was in the grass.
It was in the grass.
But we've had lots of little dandelion bouquets and buttercups and all those, and clover.
And the wild oxeye daisy. I mean, your Shasta daisies in your perennial border are not blooming yet, but the wild oxeye daisy is starting to open up. So you can have quite a long season of white daisy flowers,
exactly,
you know, if you leave them. I think
and
they're
then
very
Montauk
pretty
daisy in the fall.
In the fall, yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Ellen is calling from Brewster. Good morning, Ellen.
Good morning. I have two questions.
Sure.
Number one, I have a wisteria from my mother, which is in the perfect spot, has established, is happy. Last year it had a ton of blooms, and this year it had none. So I whacked it right after the bloom because my mother always used to complain that hers never bloomed because my father always pruned it at the wrong time. My question is, it's putting out those long gangly runners that get in the bushes and the trees. Can I whack them and still get blooms next year?
You can pinch them back. I'm not sure I'd
yep.
whack them off completely, but I definitely would pinch them back. Last year was a fabulous year for wisteria. Every wisteria I saw looked beautiful. This year, I really haven't seen the wisterias. Maybe I'm early, maybe I'm late, but I really haven't noticed wisterias blooming. So I'm thinking perhaps this year is not the best year for wisteria.
I think we lost a lot of stuff over this winter.
Yes,
yes. Which is unusual.
Yep.
What's your second question?
My second question is, I have that ubiquitous hot pink rhododendron on my property, and I noticed it seems to have reseeded. I have like maybe 15 baby rhodies.
Aren't you lucky?
Now, I'm thrilled. I'm delighted. But I didn't know that they seeded at all.
You know, surprisingly, we don't think of rhododendrons as seeding themselves, but they do. Particularly the rhododendron carolinianum, which is one of the, it's not native to New England. Rhododendron maximum is the native one. But I have collected years past when Jeannie Gillis was the horticulturist at Heritage Plantation. She once gave me a 5-gallon bucket and a trowel because I was interested in collecting seedlings, and there were tons of rhododendron seedlings coming up in the woods away from the formal plantings. And she said, go ahead into this area. And so I have a number of rhododendrons that came from seedlings at Heritage. And lo and behold, I'm clearing away some leaves and some brush in one area of the garden, and there's like half a dozen seedlings. So
yeah.
Yes, they do set seed. You can dig them up and move them to where you'd like them. It will take them a number of years, quite a few, to come into maturity and bloom. But yeah, they're fun.
Yeah.
They are. Okay, well, thank you very much, because I'm going to dig some up and move them to where I want them.
There you go.
And I'll still have a ton.
Yes, you will.
Ellen, thanks for the call, and good luck with that.
You're welcome. Thank you.
The hydrangeas, as we know, another tough winter for hydrangeas, and I'm looking, it's funny, the lace cap ones seem to do okay.
Same are fine,
I know.
Yes.
But my other ones, and now, you know, I've got the green at the bottom, and so I'm sure there's a lot of other folks are saying, okay, can I chop off those dead ones now? We can
yes,
just
please.
Chop it right off.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I did it about 2 or 3 weeks ago. I was walking through one of my gardens and said, oh, look, there's a pile of all those dead sticks I cut out because I haven't found the time to go clean. My gardens are a mess. One garden is a mess in particular this year. It's just, I can't find the time.
I know. And especially when we had that cycle of where it was raining every weekend, we couldn't get out there. I'm in the same camp. I haven't cut back my hydrangeas yet either, but I'm about to. Speaking of hydrangeas, we have the Hydrangea Festival coming up.
Oh, yes, definitely.
It's, July 6th through the 15th. Lots of stuff going on. We'll put a link on our website, capeandislands.org. I have not yet gone to the Hydrangea Festival. Have you?
I have not gone to the lectures, but I have taken advantage of visiting some of the wonderful open gardens. A lot of volunteers, a lot of fabulous gardeners on Cape Cod open their gardens during the Hydrangea Festival. And so you can see incredible designs, water gardens, sun gardens, shade gardens, all sorts of lovely stuff.
I love visiting other people, especially gardeners. You get
and
so many ideas.
I think there are five different master gardeners that have their gardens on the garden tour for the Hydrangea Fest. So yes, take advantage of it.
All right. Roberta Clark joins us the third Tuesday of every month. We'll see you next month.
You will.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.